You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the holiday 2018/2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Letter from Then by Lily Annalick. Starburst, the epic flame and epicer flameouts of Paris, Lindsay, and Brittany. Opening photo illustration by Maxomatic, showing Summiteers Brittany Spears, Paris Hilton, and Lindsay Lohan in their prime times. November 29, 2006, the New York Post ran on its front page a photo of Lindsay, Brittany, and Paris. If last names were even remotely necessary, the story wouldn't have been captured together in a single image. They were in a car, looking rowdy, reckless, ready to bust loose, raise hell, pursue the dark ecstasies of night and the city, the matching gleams in their heavily shadowed eyes telling you just how profoundly they didn't give an F. Stamped across the bottom, the headline, Bimbo Summit. There's the smug sneer of Bimbo, of course, yet there's also the grudging marvel of Summit. It's the marvel that gets it right. These three were at the center of the heat and the flash and the noise. Not merely stars, but stars that were simultaneously rising, falling, exploding, and suddenly colliding, a new kind of star being forged in the process. They understood what nobody else did, that Hollywood wasn't a geographical location, it was a state of mind, that rock and roll wasn't a musical genre, it was a way of life. And they were, in that moment, more Hollywood and rock and roll than anyone. The photograph defined that present, also this present. Lindsay, Brittany, and Paris weren't of their time. They're of ours. The world we're living in is the one they made 15 years ago. The child star, on November 21st, 2003, principal photography wrapped on the teen comedy Mean Girls. It was a sensation, as was Lindsay, its lead, known until then as the cute-as-a-button Disney Spitfire. The transition from kid performer to grown-up is a perilous one, yet no sooner had she made it than she appeared to lose interest. Sure, she was playing opposite the national treasure likes of Meryl Streep and recording certified platinum albums, hosting Saturday Night Live. Didn't it all seem a little dull, though? A little predictable, corny, old-fashioned. Her fame morphed for a second time into notoriety. She had trouble with alcohol, drugs, guys, girls, tabloids, the law. And as her reputation for unreliability grew, she not only worked less, but the work she did do was less compelling. Or perhaps it was that she was less compelled by it. Could be she concluded that the big screen was too small to accommodate her outsized talent, personality, ambition. Consider this. Lindsay, in 2011, acting career on the skids, walks into a Los Angeles courtroom to plead not guilty to felony grand theft. She'd boosted, allegedly, a $2,500 necklace. Wearing dark glasses and a white sheath dress, the mob of reporters surrounding her indistinguishable from a film premiere mob. Incidentally, the dress, a Kimberly Ovitz, sold out almost instantly. As an entrance, it was unalloyed movie star, classic, and iconic, as full of sex and glamour and danger as Rita Hayworth's in Gilda. The underage star, on August 28, 2003, at the MTV Video Music Awards, Britney, a blushing bride in go-go boots of immaculate white, open-mouth-kissed her studly groom, a tuxedoed Madonna. It marked a distinct shift in her persona, up to then schizo. Her first ooh, baby, baby, had slid into our collective ear as hot and wet as a tongue 5 years prior. Since she wasn't quite 17, and thus wasn't quite barely legal, however, her knowingness was impermissible, and so she obligingly pretended not to know. She posed as the girl next door, corn-fed and church-going, and utterly unaware of her absolute erotic power. That was the secret of her success, giving us, along with illicit spectacle, plausible deniability. Until she no longer could. At those 2003 VMAs, the contradiction that informed her being finally tore her apart from the inside out. She was the sex bomb that went off and on a rampage. Marriage to childhood friend Jason Alexander, over after 2 days via annulment. Marriage to backup dancer Kevin Federline, over via text after 2 years. A shaved head, menstrual blood-stained undies, no undies at all. The most shocking moment came at the 2007 VMAs, where she performed Gimme More, its opening salvo, It's Britney, Bitch, not simply a declaration of self, but a declaration of who we were in relation to that self. The old coyness was gone. And though, according to the song's lyrics, it's us demanding that Britney gimme more, also reflected her own appetite. Lust might be the better word for it. Insatiable, unappeasable, monstrous. It's what made her great. It's what made her doomed. The performance was universally mocked, with her undone hair, less-is-less costume, refusal to bother to keep up even the pretense of lip-syncing, Britney was an easy target. A cultural pinnacle treated as a pop-cultural nadir, her downward slide accelerated, stopping at last on January 3, 2008, when she was strapped to a gurney and shoved into the back of an ambulance bound for Cedars-Sinai and an emergency psych eval, laughing as she cried. Middle finger raised to the heavens as cameras flashed like strobe lights and helicopters glittered like disco balls. Our Lolita was now our Medusa. The adult star. On December 2, 2003, The Simple Life, an unscripted series about city slicker sophisticates, Paris and best friend Nicole Richie, transplanted to the sticks, premiered on Fox. Until then, Paris was something of a throwback. An heiress to the Hilton Hotel's fortune, she was what Walter Winchell in 1939 dubbed a celebutante. In other words, a rich girl whose madcap antics were followed by the press. She'd recently become another kind of throwback as well. Weeks before, her ex, poker player and scumbag Rick Salomon, had released a video account of the then couple engaged in various intimate acts. Yet if the leak was a personal humiliation for Paris, she'd later describe it as akin to rape. It was a professional triumph. Out of necessity, she'd taken a page from the playbook of Marilyn Monroe, who, in the early 50s, confessed to being the nude in the Golden Dreams calendar, and went from dim starlet to supernova. The Simple Life proved a ratings smash. Suddenly, Paris was everywhere, as inescapable as she was inevitable. A note on Paris as philosopher and revolutionary, 20th century thinking dictated that the great cultural contribution of the movies, was the movies, a dynamic new popular art form. Paris, however, a 21st century thinker and pioneer reality TV luminary, instinctively grasped that the great cultural contribution of the movie was movie stars. Since anybody with a phone was now a potential cineaste, cells with built-in cameras became widely available in O2. Life was the movie, one that never faded to black. And since true movie stars require raw presence, not refined acting skills, she need only ever perform herself. Or rather, herself, a gorgeous blonde ditz, the modern-day Monroe. When stars collide, one of two things happens. They form a larger star, or they fall into a black hole. October 14th, 2007, Black Hole Time. Keeping Up with the Kardashians, featuring Paris's former gopher and closet arranger Kim, premiered. Kim, too, would make a sex tape, released, pardon me, leaked, shortly before her own show's debut, and to much the same effect. I'd say Kim took out Lindsay, Brittany, and Paris, except the three had more or less taken themselves out by then, collapsed under the strain of sustaining their legends. Paris couldn't seem to stop getting busted for drug and alcohol-related offenses. Likewise, Lindsay, who was doing time in rehab, and we know what happened to Brittany. Trailblazers so often crack up, devolve into fanatics, crazies. Nor is it merely that Kim's persisted, she's proliferated, has, in effect, become a factory, mass-producing clones, first Courtney and Chloe, then Kendall and Kylie. And so the rebellion was co-opted, institutionalized, turned into a brand, rugged individualism giving way to corporate interest. Being a reality star is no longer risky or disreputable. It's just an updated version of ingenue, another path well-trodden to riches and fame. Kylie, Forbes' August 31st cover girl, is set to become the world's youngest ever self-made billionaire. The anti-career is now the career, which is why the thrill is gone and isn't coming back. Unless, of course, the summit can somehow be persuaded to reconvene. Hit us, Lindsay, Brittany, Paris, one more time. Now this from James Walcott. Bada Bing's Big Bang. With its portrayal of white malaise, The Sopranos presaged an epochal culture shift. Opening illustration by Jimmy Terrell. Tony Soprano's shadow looms large over 21st century America. Once upon a crime, a mound of a man lumbered outside in a bathrobe to feed a family of ducks in his backyard pool. What joyous delight he took in their playful splashing! It was our deceptively genial introduction to Tony Soprano, James Gandolfini, mobster, suburban dad, cheating husband, henpecked son, sullen brooder, and volatile bruiser who was larger than life at the start and grew ever larger until his beastie breathing could be heard across the room like a minotaur biding its time. The on-screen couplings, rub-outs, beat-downs, and Jungian dreamwalks of Gandolfini's sumo mafioso on HBO's The Sopranos would climax 85 episodes later in an enigmatic cut to black, whose meaning remains a topic of grassy knoll interpretation and metaphysical debate. Was it finally lights out for Tony, the hitman cometh? Or was the shock edit an arbitrary M-dash to nowhere, like ending a novel in mid-sentence? The irresolution of Tony's fate keeps him alive as legend, his final expressionless glance and inscrutable tease. Created by David Chase, whose previous TV credits, The Rockford Files, I'll Fly Away, Northern Exposure, gave little hint of the depth charges he would detonate here, The Sopranos ushered itself from inception into the gangster saga's royal line of succession that originated with Scarface and The Public Enemy, and was raised to opera morte with the Godfather movies. An early meeting of Tony's crew at the Bada Bing strip club was bathed in sacristy shadow and painterly light in homage to Godfather cinematographer Gordon Willis, whose name is invoked in the same episode, and Goodfellas, whose cast included future Sopranos fixtures Michael Imperioli as Tony's rash nephew Christopher, Tony Sirico, the natty-dressing malapropistic Polly Walnuts, Frank Vincent, gang boss Phil Leotardo, and Lorraine Bracco, Tony's shrink Dr. Melfi. The Sopranos soon moved beyond mere invocation and sly homage. It became its own flexing organism and powerhouse. The show made stars of its mostly little-known cast, racked up ratings and Emmy Awards, built the DVD market for quality TV and the inevitable lavish boxed set, provided a launch pad for writer-producer-directors Terrence Winter, who went on to do Boardwalk Empire, and Matthew Weiner, mastermind of Mad Men and the Romanoffs, raised the television recap to a state of exalted exegesis, and fertilized a small library of soprano studies, The Sopranos, Born Under a Bad Sign, The Sopranos and Philosophy, Tony Soprano on Management, whose latest thumper is The Sopranos Sessions, a 20th anniversary tribute to the series, written by noted deep-sea diving television critics Alan Sepinwall and Matt Zoller-Seitz, and bearing the heft of a family Bible, if your family likes to gather around the hearth and share fond reflections of how and when Big Pussy got whacked. Interviewed by the authors for a long postmortem, it reads like an extended commentary track. David Chase takes the Marcus Aurelius long view of the transience of human endeavor, denying that the Sopranos will have any legacy, destined to join the stardust that yawns ahead. In the fullness of time, perhaps so, but in the lousy here and now, The Sopranos retains a deep admonitory hoofprint, and forgive the word, relevance. It holds up as quality crime drama and soap opera, and its violence, at its worst overly florid and sadistic, still has the clout to shock, even when you know what's coming. But other series are rewatchable and influential without wielding lasting diagnostic abilities bordering on the prophetic. Depicting how things were then with evocation and a keen eye and ear for entropy, The Sopranos shows how we got to where we are now, a country stewing in its own stale juices. Coming at the ragged end of the Bill Clinton era, and sticking around through most of the Bush presidency, The Sopranos records and preserves the cusp of the pre-9/11, post-9/11 atmospheric shift, when national confidence had the wind knocked out of it, and terrorism superseded organized crime as the chief preoccupation of the feds, the red needle on the fear gauge. It pulls back the tarp of the underlying malaise afflicting white America, a malaise compounded of post-war nostalgia, creeping age, waning virility and vital purpose, and a nagging belatedness. Tony himself, "Lately, I'm getting the feeling that I came in at the end. The best is over." The gong of decline is tolled at the outset. The rackets aren't bringing in the money they used to. The minorities are taking over. Why can't things be the way they used to when young snots respected their elders? Made men didn't cut deals and rat out associates, but took the full rap. And they played Jerry Vale on the radio. Way down the line in episode 80, Tony, tired of listening to Paulie's nattering on about the glory days, silences the dinner table with a dismissive, "Remember when is the lowest form of conversation?" But that reflects Tony's irritation with Paulie's lack of an off switch on his mouth, more than a revulsion at reminiscing. Remembering when is an irresistible tug and drug on The Sopranos, its characters as mired in the monochrome past and the thickets of family lore as the residents of William Faulkner's fable Yanapatapa County. What Chase and his writers grasped is that the nostalgia of Tony and Company isn't a soft, cotton-candied wistfulness of the way things were. There's a hard edge to it, an anger simmering beneath, a bitter entitlement looking for an excuse to lash out. It's the grapes of wrath. The Sopranos reveals how a certain vintage of white person has perfected the art of playing the victim. One of the show's genius strokes was casting Nancy Marchand, best known then as the Katharine Graham-ish Minchie newspaper proprietor in TV's Lou Grant, as Tony's mother, Livia, the most unnurturing mother ever inflicted on a sensitive brute, cawing, "Oh, poor you," at Tony after he indulges in one of his sad sack complaints, a line reading for the ages. Yet Livia, malignant as she is, shades of Cheyenne Phillips' Livia and I, Claudius, is likewise suffused in maudlin, martyr self-pity, wearing her crummy house coat like widow's weeds, and dabbing at a faucet drip of crocodile tears as she bemoans being chucked onto the scrap heap of life. As for Uncle Junior, Dominic Chianese, don't get him started. He'll chew the bark off the entire drive home with his complaining. The Sopranos is a choral litany of bitching and bemoaning, rooted in bad faith, a refusal to take responsibility for their own actions and instead play the blame game. It's the Make America Great Again mentality in its dormancy, Trumpiness on training wheels. The mordant irony of The Sopranos is that the gravest violence isn't the staccato killings and maimings meted out episode after episode to this mook or that, but the slow-motion assault on the environment that unfolds like a curse. Tony fronts as a waste management consultant. Technically true, if by waste management you mean disposing of dead bodies within a tri-state area and convenient waterways. And what helps bankroll the gangster lifestyle of him and those around him is a diversified operation of toxic dumping, half-assed asbestos removal, and garbage hauling to God knows where, along with the usual extortion, hijacking, and other fun stuff. As the mob operations befoul air, water, and soil with carcinogens, karma exacts its toll fee. The characters are a virtual cancer cluster. Uncle Junior, who survives, Pauly Walnuts, ditto, Bobby Bacalaria Jr., Jackie April Sr., and saving the best worst for last, Johnny Sack. A heavy cloud cover of mortality hangs over the Sopranos, a wintry load, and it's telling that the only truly joyous moment of carefree laughter Tony Soprano enjoys is in the pool with the splashing ducks. Once they depart, it's paradise lost.
Thank you.
Now for this month's cover story, Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious Miranda. He sings, he dances, he writes Tony-winning musicals and Oscar-nominated scores. And now he's starring in Mary Poppins Returns. As Bruce Handy writes, there's no such thing as just a spoonful of supercalifragilisticexpialidocious Miranda. Photographs by Ethan James Green, styled by Samira Nasser. Opening photo, Jolly Holiday, Lin-Manuel Miranda photographed in New York City, suspended between two ladders, hanging on by his cane. The first image you see in Mary Poppins Returns is a gas flame dancing in an old-fashioned street lamp just before dawn. It's an apt way to start the movie, which more than half a century later means to rekindle the spirit of Walt Disney's 1964 adaptation of the P.L. Travers children's books. Some would argue, well, I would, that the original Mary Poppins is the greatest of Walt Disney pictures. Disney, the actual man and studio head, so that crafting a sequel is a Herculean and possibly foolish task. Blame or salute director Rob Marshall, Chicago, Into the Woods, screenwriter David McGee, Life of Pi, and songwriters Mark Shaman and Scott Whitman, Hairspray. But here we are. The second thing you see in Mary Poppins Returns is a close-up of Lin-Manuel Miranda, tending the flame literally and figuratively as a Cockney lamplighter named Jack. Those of us happy just to have had tickets in the rear balcony when we saw Hamilton, the epical hip-hop musical Miranda wrote and starred in on Broadway, or In the Heights, his first show and the rare Broadway hit with Latin music actually written by Latinos, may not have realized how expressive his big brown eyes are, especially on a movie screen. Here, with his face shorn of its customary beard and mustache, those eyes, no longer counterbalanced by whiskers, look almost ridiculously Kenyan large. They've been unleashed like a pair of excited puppies, adorable and up for anything. In tandem with the gaslight, they seem meant to welcome us into the magical, innocent, sentimental world of Mary Poppins Returns, and they give us the first hint that this thing might work. You no doubt remember Bert, Dick Van Dyke's chimney sweep and one-man band from the original. Miranda's Jack serves much the same purpose here, as both a scene setter and a sidekick to Mary Poppins herself. Indeed, we are told that Jack was once apprenticed to Bert as a boy, back around the time of the first movie. The new one picks up with the Banks family 25 or so years later in the pre-war 30s, with London gripped by the Great Slump, as Brits style the Depression. Marshall's Mary Poppins living in a world just a shade darker than Uncle Walt's. Bert himself is no longer in evidence, having presumably passed on to one of those clouds we first saw Mary perched on more than 50 years ago. Mr. and Mrs. Banks have also left us. Every other principal from the first movie has aged appropriately. Michael Banks, Ben Whishaw, is now a widowed father of three. Jane Banks, Emily Mortimer, is a union organizer and devoted aunt. But Mary herself is unchanged and eternally youthful, except that she now looks like Emily Blunt, rather than Julie Andrews, and owns a slightly snappier wardrobe. There is a functional plot having to do with an evil banker, Colin Firth, who means to repossess 17 Cherry Tree Lane, the Banks' homestead, and parental challenges requiring magic nanny intervention. But what will matter more is that there are new songs, a few tears, and a goofy cameo by Meryl Streep. There is Blunt inhabiting the role with all due banister-ascending mischief and spit-spot persnicketiness. And there is Lin-Manuel Miranda, who looks like he is having a blast, which is largely what his character is asked to do. I choose to interpret his wobbly Cockney accent as a tribute to Dick Van Dyke's famously unconvincing stab at same. Rob Marshall and John DeLuca, Marshall's producing partner as well as his partner, cast Miranda after seeing him in Hamilton, consciously following the template set by Walt Disney, who gave Andrews her first big screen role in Mary Poppins, after she had become a Broadway star in My Fair Lady and Camelot. We were blown away by the spirit behind Lin's work as an actor. There's an unusual purity to it, Marshall told me. What's so fascinating about getting to know Lin personally is that there's not a jaded bone in his body, and we were looking for Jack to have an optimism, a childlike sensibility. Lin just has that it thing, and it comes right through the lens. Not a jaded bone in his body. Sam Wasson, a friend of Miranda's from their undergraduate days at Wesleyan, said much the same thing when he described Miranda as a human gumdrop. At Wesleyan, Wasson and Miranda worked on shows together, including an improv group that Miranda played music for. He was game for anything, Wasson said. He had a little Mickey and Judy feeling in him. Let's go, let's do it. It'd be impossible to think of Lin as depressed in any way, which makes me hate him. You want to think, oh, genius comes with darkness. And I'm sure it's there, but I haven't seen it. Another word that comes up repeatedly while talking to Miranda's friends and colleagues is ebullient. It's a quality that's palpable, not just in his persona and his performances. It also animates his relentlessly upbeat Twitter feed as he bounces between sharing cute videos of his kids and showering his 2.53 million followers with daily affirmations. Good morning. Give your time. Give your heart, give your talent, give something new. It feels incredible. More importantly, that positivity courses through the shows that made Miranda's name. There was an electric cultural synergy when Hamilton debuted in 2015 with Barack Obama in the White House. Miranda's book, score, and cast implicitly conflated the revolutionary energies of a young nation with those of our multicultural moment. But Hamilton's opening night on Broadway was August 6th, just weeks after Donald Trump announced he was running for president. As in Mary Poppins, London, things have changed, and lights in the darkness must now burn brighter than ever. Mary doesn't age, right? Which makes her kind of like a Time Lord. That was Miranda one afternoon this summer explaining the ground rules of what I hope no one at Disney refers to as the Poppins verse. Time Lord, I had to look it up, is a reference to Doctor Who and that series' race of time-bending aliens who can also regenerate themselves whenever plot twist or casting changes demand. You can imagine the novel appeal of characters who have literally all the time in the world to someone whose signature work is about a man haunted by the specter of an early death. As Miranda's Eliza Hamilton sings to her husband, "Why do you write like you're running out of time?" It's a refrain that underscores Miranda's own life and work well beyond Hamilton. If you look at In the Heights, it's also a show about legacy and what you leave behind. That's in the fabric of a lot of the things that Lin makes. That and asking the question, "Have I done enough?" said Thomas Kail, who directed In the Heights as well as Hamilton. Lin has a real understanding of how fleeting everything is. The only time you ever really see Lin scared is if you ask him to cross the street, not at a crosswalk. He's conscious that things could end, and he's conscious of the randomness of things. So he tries to impose some kind of order within that chaos. You and I might well think that, yes, Miranda has done enough, given that he's only 38 and already has a Pulitzer Prize, a MacArthur Genius Grant, an armful of Tonys and Grammys, and an Emmy, leaving him just an Oscar short of an EGOT. He earned a nomination in 2017 for Best Original Song for How Far I'll Go, one of his contributions to the Moana score. Then, again, you and I are probably not the sort of people who would read an 818-page biography of a founding father while on vacation in Mexico and say to ourselves while floating on a lounger, this needs to be a hip-hop musical. Or so goes the Hamilton origin story. Next, photographs by Andres Kudaki. Time on his side. Miranda in Washington, D.C. last June with his nephew, Luis Crespo, Jr., guest at a cocktail reception, and his mother, Dr. Luz Towns Miranda. Consider the rush of Miranda-related events this past summer, which a friend of his likened to a Lin-Manuel Miranda advent calendar. In late June, Warner Brothers announced that it would be releasing a movie version of In the Heights in 2020 to be directed by John M. Chu, now among the most bankable filmmakers in Hollywood thanks to Crazy Rich Asians. Then, in short succession across July, it was announced that Miranda would himself be directing a film adaptation of Tick, Tick, Boom, the Jonathan Larson musical that isn't Rent, that Miranda would executive produce a limited series for FX based on a biography of the director and choreographer Bob Fosse, with Sam Rockwell as Fosse and Michelle Williams as the dancer Gwen Verdon, Fosse's wife and muse. That he would be co-starring in a BBC adaptation of Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials trilogy. That Penguin Random House would publish an illustrated collection of his most uplifting go-get'em tweets. That he had started a multi-million-dollar fund to promote the arts in Puerto Rico in the wake of Hurricane Maria, and that all the profits from a previously announced 3-week San Juan production of Hamilton, which Miranda will be starring in come January, reprising the title role for the first time since he left the Broadway production in 2016, will go to benefit the Arts Fund. This last announcement was made at a press conference in Puerto Rico, where both Miranda's parents are from, and where he spent considerable time as a boy while growing up in New York City. Pity the fans, not to mention the journalist, who have to keep up with all of this. I interviewed Miranda in New York a few days after the press conference. His public schedule began that morning at 7:20, with him tweeting a video he'd taken of himself in a subway station performing a discarded rap from Bring It On, the musical, the 2012 Broadway cheerleading show based on the film franchise, for which he'd co-written the music and lyrics. Even bigger news came a few hours later. The committee behind the Kennedy Center honors was bestowing an unprecedented special award to Hamilton, the first time the center had honored a specific work as opposed to artists or performers with extensive bodies of work. Thus, this month, Miranda, Cale, musical director Alex Lacamoire, and choreographer Andy Blankenbuehler will be feted at the Kennedy Center's annual gala alongside Philip Glass, Reba McEntire, Wayne Shorter, and Cher. Cher. Of course, Miranda has a Cher story. She saw him in Hamilton, but didn't come backstage because, as she explained in a subsequent note, her tears had ruined her makeup, which might be Miranda's most unlikely feat of all, making Cher feel shy. He and I met in the apartment he rents as a workspace and hang out in Washington Heights. People assume per the title of his first show, that Miranda grew up in the Heights in northern Manhattan, but his family actually lived 30 blocks further uptown in Inwood. This apartment is not far from the one where he lives with his wife, Vanessa Nadal, a chemist turned lawyer, and their two young sons, a four-year-old and a baby who was born this past February, a few hours after Miranda and Nadal saw an early cut of Mary Poppins Returns. As he put it, "If you ask me how's the movie, I go, it is labor-inducingly good." He'd only just arrived in town that morning on a red-eye from Los Angeles, where he'd flown from Puerto Rico for 2 days of work and meetings, but he showed no signs of jet lag. Sort of the opposite, in fact. He was full of energy, nervous or otherwise, and couldn't stop bouncing all over his chair, straddling the arms at times or perching on the back. At one point, he sprawled on the floor to show me how the camera had been placed for a tricky motorized shot in one of Mary Poppins Returns numbers. You could see why he had been drawn to performing in the first place. It was almost as if being asked to sit in one place for 2 hours was a physical affront. That impression was confirmed by Chiara Alegria Hudis, the Pulitzer-winning playwright for Water by the Spoonful, who wrote the book for In the Heights. Once or twice during previews for that show, Miranda was forced to let an understudy take over his role so he could sit in the audience with Hudes and, as she said, put his author hat back on for some things we needed to fix. And I remember one time he turned to me and he just looked miserable, which is not something Lynn looks very often. He is an incredibly happy human being. But he looked dreadful, just ashen in the face, and I was like, "What's wrong?" And he was like, "How do you do this? How do you sit and watch every night? It's the worst experience. It's awful. There's nothing I can do with my nervous energy." It is tribute to both his creative intensity and the frenzy generated by Hamilton's success that Miranda can make taking on his first major movie sound like an escape. Never mind that Mary Poppins Returns represents an enormous creative risk for all concerned. Marshall and DeLuca offered him the part while he was nearing the end of his one-year commitment to his Hamilton role. "A year," he said, "that's like when my warranty runs out, so this really was a weird kind of a lifeline. It was getting a bit crazy, the celebrity thing about Hamilton here in New York, and to chop my hair off and leave the country was a very enticing prospect. The offer helped at home, too. The other thing you have to know is my wife is Dominican and Austrian. She was born in Sweden and wants to live everywhere in the world. My first musical is literally about how I do not want to leave Washington Heights." Thus, the prospect of spending a year working in London and submitting himself to someone else's vision for a change held the bonus appeal of resolving his Green Acres-style conflict. Though Nadal told me she thought her husband was perhaps exaggerating for effect regarding that last point, and also regarding his relief at being offered the role and his eagerness to skip town. "I think he's underselling himself a little bit," she said. "He would have also been happy to stay in New York, and he would have figured out his next career move. But it had been an exhausting year. We would have to take a very long vacation." When I ask if Miranda ever gets depressed or mopey or just vaguely down in private, she replied, following a deliberative pause, "I will say that the public perception is not very far off the truth. He has a very positive attitude almost all the time." She then told me a story about how, when he learned Beyoncé and Jay-Z were coming to see Hamilton, Miranda had vowed to perform that day, even though he had a 104-degree fever. He was like, "Maybe I can do it," and I was like, "You can't do it. You're crazy." Nadal won that argument. As a kid, Miranda had a complicated relationship with Mary Poppins. He still remembers the VHS case fondly, but the movie itself gave him pause. "I couldn't get through Feed the Birds," he admitted, referring to the gorgeous, melancholy lullaby Andrews sings halfway through the movie, about an old woman in rags who sells birdseed on the steps of St. Paul's. The kind of glum note the new movie amplifies just a bit. "I was very sensitive to minor key music, and that song was so sad that I don't think I saw the ending of Mary Poppins until I was grown, because I would just cry. I loved supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. I loved Dick Van Dyke. I loved the whole movie, but then that one song was so sad I kind of never survived it." Having a strong emotional response to music at a young age is often cited as evidence that a child has a musical gift. A friend of mine's kindergarten-age son was accepted to a program for piano prodigies, in part because he wept listening to Chopin. I ask if Miranda had often responded to songs so passionately as a kid, and he practically jumped out of his chair. My family had so many stories about that, about how Stevie Wonder's "I Just Called to Say I Love You" would come on, and they'd have to change the channel because I would burst into tears. You know what? I actually remember the feeling. I remember it with so many no's in the lyrics. No New Year's Day to celebrate. It felt apocalyptic to me as a little kid. No songs to sing. I was like, turn it off. I was very sensitive. Bridge Over Troubled Water apparently just laid me out when I was an infant. My parents have all kinds of stories like that. His parents' record collection is a big part of Miranda's own origin story. The show tunes from Broadway cast albums they'd relax to, and the salsa and merengue they'd play at dance parties. Both strains entwining to form his musical DNA, along with the hip-hop he absorbed as a kid, which served as a kind of accelerant. Another key influence, seeing Rent on his 17th birthday. Jonathan Larson connected the dots in musicals, that this thing you love can reflect the world in which you live. "I loved musicals, but they never reflected the world in which I lived. It was just a separate thing I liked." He connected those dots for me, and I think I really started writing and felt like I could write a musical because of Jonathan Larson. Which makes Miranda's directing a movie version of Tick, Tick, Boom a form of debt service. Larson's autobiographical show, its earliest version, first performed off-Broadway in 1990, centers on a marginally successful musical theater composer who is contemplating giving it up as his 30th birthday looms. The stage production opened to the literal sound of a ticking clock. The show has a happy ending, but it's impossible not to view it through the bitter lens of Larson's shocking death in 1996 from an aortic aneurysm at the age of 35, the morning of Rent's first off-Broadway performance, which is about as cruelly ironic as death gets in real life. Rent, of course, is stalked by death, too, in the form of HIV/AIDS. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman.